Thanks very much, Ian. Well, welcome to the Albert Hall for a prom dedicated to the memory of Sir Charles Mackerras. Tonight was to have been the first of his two proms appearances this season. Sadly, Sir Charles died earlier on this month, and as Roger Wright, director of the BBC Proms, puts it in a special note in tonight's programme, our musical world is a poorer place without him. He was indeed an extraordinary musician and a scholar, but he was also a charmingly good-humoured man, as anyone who had the good fortune to meet him would know. His enthusiasm for music really rubbed off on all the musicians that he worked with. So somehow it would feel wrong to pay tribute to him with a concert of sombre music. Instead, Vasily Sinaisky, who's the BBC Philharmonic's chief guest conductor, who's taken Sir Charles's place tonight, has kept the programme pretty much as it was. It's a collection of joyful music that seems to celebrate life. There's the bubbly conversational piano concerto by Schumann with the soloist Christian Zacharias, and a second half of Viennese favourites from the waltz king Johann Strauss the Younger, with just an added nod to Sir Charles Mackerras's beloved Czech repertoire in the shape of one of Dvořák's Slavonic dances. So before the interval, we have Schumann's piano concerto. And before that, a purely orchestral piece which Schumann wrote around the same time, the overture, scherzo and finale. This is Schumann very much on a high. It's 1841, shortly after he's married Clara, and he's exhilarated and working very, very hard, as well as enjoying time with his family. The overture, scherzo and finale is just that, three movements, which Schumann said could be played on their own, but put together they make up what he described as a symphonette, not quite a full symphony in scale, just over a quarter of an hour long, but still substantial enough to Schumann to agree to it being called his second symphony when it was first published. Now, the applause you're hearing now is for Yuri Turchinsky, the leader of the BBC Philharmonic, making his way on stage in front of a packed Royal Albert Hall. And following closely behind, tonight's conductor, Vasily Sinaisky, making his way onto the stage of the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in the overture, scherzo and finale by Robert Schumann.
Thank you.
The Overture Scherzo and Finale by Schumann, performed here at the BBC Proms live by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Vasily Sinaisky, who ended with a charming smile to the audience as he turned around on the podium as that piece came to a close. It's interesting, I reckon you could probably write a PhD about when it is and isn't appropriate to clap between movements, but I think it probably was completely appropriate for people to clap between the movements of that, because Schumann did say the Overture, Scherzo and Finale could all be heard separately as self-standing movements. He also described that piece as having a light and pleasant character. Schumann's music tends often to have quite a strong character, sometimes one, sometimes two or more. And rather famously, in conjunction with what we now consider to have been bipolar disorder, he described the two sides of his own character, the manic and the depressive, as two of the commedia dell'arte characters, the heroic and outgoing Florestan and the introverted Eusebius. And often these two characters crop up in his music, as they do in the next piece we're going to hear this evening, the Piano Concerto. Schumann wrote it roughly the same time as the Overture, Scherzo and Finale. And Clara, his wife, naturally was the soloist he wrote it for. She was one of the great piano virtuosos of her day. And yet this work doesn't fit the typical virtuoso model of a 19th century concerto. There's quite a damning judgment of the work from Liszt, who heard it and described it as a concerto without piano. But tonight's soloist, Christian Zacharias, rather disagrees with Liszt.
It is a piano concerto with a lot of piano, because when you play it, you realize you're all the time playing. But it is involved in the whole thing, so you are often playing accompanying figures because the clarinet is playing something, or the winds are restating the theme. So, of course, Liszt didn't like the fact that it was so well in the pattern of everything. It's never shining too far out like a typical Chopin or Liszt concert.
What would you say the character of this piece is overall? I mean, Schumann actually, you know, there's a lot of character in his work, you know, particularly with this dual personality, Florestan Eusebius. Does this piece for you have a particular character?
Yeah, if you start with Florestan and Eusebius, it is, of course, this change of energy into letting things happen and being a bit passive and then taking up again. And this may be also the reason why it is exaggerated. So you start the piece with this, I mean, also virtuoso kind of approach. The piano is there immediately showing, wow, even faster than in the Liszt concerto. I mean, Liszt might not have heard the piano, but there's no concerto where the piano starts a millisecond after the first beat of the orchestra, and very forceful. And then immediately Eusebius comes, I would say, and does this kind of lyrical idea. But this is the thing, it always changes between Aufschwung, as he also often called it, this kind of energy, appassionato, going forward and going high, you know, rising and being optimistic. And then, yeah, oh God, let's be a bit quiet and suffer a little bit. And this goes on almost all the time. And the slow movement has something which he has also in his piano solo music. It's a little conversation, I mean, like a Biedermeier scene. Very light, very over the fence, I would almost say, in the garden, you know, talking to somebody. So this is an approach which also you won't find in enormous concertos, because it's too intimate. It's chamber music on a conversation style. And then the last movement is more the Florestan dancing waltz person with, in the middle, changing the waltz into some meter, which is very irritating for many people, because you lose the ground under your feet rhythmically. And there Schumann is absolutely unique.
And what's the experience like for you performing this as a soloist with conductor? Because I know that you direct it from the piano yourself with your own ensemble, the Lausanne.
Often it is harder to convince your partners conducting, because, of course, they want to do their thing and they are the boss. So it needs more diplomacy, of course. But here I'm very lucky because Vasily was immediately on the boat and he tried to be my advocate. And then, of course, you have your hands free. I mean, you are relaxed, you can play. They are cared for by somebody, so you don't have to have two minds all the time and try to be with the orchestra as well.
Tonight's soloist, Christian Zacharias, who makes his way onto the platform of the Royal Albert Hall now, closely followed by Vasily Sinaisky. Zacharias takes his place at the piano, which has magically appeared on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall with the BBC Philharmonic, to perform the Piano Concerto in A Minor by Robert Schumann.
Thank you.
Schumann's A minor piano concerto played by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Vasily Sinaisky with the soloist Christian Zacharias. And a warm handshake and a pat on the back between the two of them. Christian Zacharias perhaps in a way saying to Vasily Sinaisky how nice it was to perform that simply as a soloist and not to have to be conducting it as well. A work which Christian Zacharias was last at the Proms performing both as soloist and as conductor with his usual ensemble, the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra. We heard Christian Zacharias earlier on describing that as an over-the-fence piece, not meaning on the fence, but a conversational work, as though you were a neighbour leaning over the fence of a garden to have a conversation with your next-door neighbour. And I think that's an absolutely brilliant description of that music. Forever after, I would like it to be known as Schumann's Over-the-Fence Concerto. Christian Zacharias there motioning to Vasily Sinaisky to come and join him at the front, their hands held. He's a performer who doesn't seem to flout a great deal of ego on stage, very humble, and motions always to the players to thank them for their performance too. Well, we heard those wonderful cross rhythms in the final movement of that concerto, what Christian Zacharias describes as a hidden waltz, which is a taste of things to come. Viennese waltz is in the second half of tonight's prom, and we'll also be paying tribute to Sir Charles Mackerras, who would have been conducting tonight, but sadly he died earlier on this month. Well, I was talking earlier on this afternoon to another great Schumann pianist, Lucy Parham, who described that Schumann piano concerto as one of the most difficult to play, even though it sounds relatively easy. She and I were across the road from the Royal Albert Hall at the Royal College of Music for a Proms Plus event earlier on this afternoon. Robert and Clara Schumann are music's golden couple in a way, individually two of the most talented and inspired musicians of the 19th century, and together making a marriage of souls and a real meeting of minds. But they don't get a Hollywood ending, sadly. Not long into their marriage, Robert's declining mental health led to a dramatic suicide attempt in his final years he spent at the Endenich Asylum. And we're here at the Royal College of Music now to find out a bit more about Robert and Clara, to dig deeper into the story of their meeting and their first years of marriage, in their own words, read by the actors Gabrielle Drake and Henry Goodman, and in the words of the pianist and Schumann expert Lucy Parham. So a warm welcome for them, please. Now, Lucy, they met when Clara was very, very young indeed, still a child. How did that meeting come about?
Well, what happened was when Clara was only 10 years old, she was being groomed for stardom by her rather famous piano teacher father called Friedrich Wieck. And his fame had spread far and wide. And Schumann, who was studying law at the time, really wanted to become a pianist and turned up at their house to have lessons with her father. But as I said, she was only 10 at the time, so...
His eyes were elsewhere at that point.
His eyes were always somewhere.
And what then happened to bring them together? We're going to hear Clara's reaction to their first kiss in just a moment. But what are the sequence of events leading up to that kiss?
Well, I think it's interesting because they obviously spent a lot of time together. She played a lot of his early compositions. She was very inspired by his music. And they spent a lot of time talking. He was in the house a lot. I would imagine in the beginning he was more like an older brother. But as things happen like that in life, they grew closer. And there became a point when he realised that she was more than a child and she had blossomed into a young woman.
And then he kissed her.
When you gave me that first kiss, I thought I would faint. Everything went blank and I could barely hold the lamp that was lighting your way out.
Oh, my Clara. Your radiant image shines through the darkness and helps me to bear everything better. I'm quite clear about my heart. Perhaps your father will not refuse if I ask him for his blessing. Fate always intended us for one another. I've known that a long, long time. But my hopes were never strong enough to tell you and to get your answer before. The room's getting dark. Passengers near me are going to sleep. It's sleeting and snowing outside, but I will squeeze myself into a corner, bury my face in the cushions, and think only of you, your Robert.
I saw you 2 steps away from me and could not get out of the carriage to throw myself into your arms. As you came towards me, I felt as though I would faint because of the pain. Everything turned black, and when I could see you no longer, my heart opened and the tears flowed so that I could not hide them. The feeling was indescribable. And how full of longing my music sounds now. My heart is eased by its tones, and so often it is my only consolation.
Clara, are you still firm and true? As indestructible as my belief in you is, even the strongest person loses confidence when nothing is heard of the one who is loved more than anything else in the world. And you are that to me. I've thought it over 1,000 times, and everything says to us, it must be if we wish it and act. Oh, I see you everywhere. You walk up and down with me in my room, you lie in my arms, and nothing's real. Oh, how long will this all endure? I want you all together for whole days, whole years, the whole of eternity.
They are such passionate letters. And Lucy, one of the things that we're hearing in those last 2 accounts is that they're separated. So they're no longer able to meet as they could do before they were lovers and perhaps secretly engaged. And this is all because of Clara's father, Friedrich Wieck. What was his objection?
Well, Clara's father had spent a lot of time and invested many hours in his daughter, whom he saw possibly as a money earner. His nickname was Alice Gelt, all money. And he had put so much effort into her that I think, to be fair from his point of view, the thought that she was going to run off and get married when she was just, you know, really a teenager and lose the career that he had dreamt of for her, really disturbed him. Having said that, he was also extremely tyrannical, and he decided the best way to basically separate them was to forbid any contact between the two. But as we all know, once anything's forbidden, it becomes far more enticing.
Doesn't it just? But I mean, do you think he would have felt like that about any man? Had he kind of the design that his daughter should stay single and an independent money-earning woman? Or do you think he might have approved of a different husband?
I actually think it was a little bit of both. I mean, at the time that Clara was clearly infatuated with Robert, he tried to bring another suitor closer to her own age into the house, and she wasn't having any of it because her heart was elsewhere. But I do think that he didn't want any man to take her at all. But when a man did arrive, he should be a very wealthy man, which Schumann wasn't, and he didn't want her having to really do anything to earn any money apart from just play the piano.
Was it just Schumann's poverty that he objected to? Or was there something else about Schumann, his character, perhaps his artistic temperament?
I think Schumann was already known for having a lot of mood swings. It's not known whether Clara's father, Friedrich Wieck, whether he knew that Schumann did have syphilis. I suspect if he had known, that would have been very good grounds for him objecting to any union between the two of them. But I think it's very important to remember that Clara was really his life's work, and quite honestly, anything that got in the way of that, he wasn't going to have the half of.
In a way, it's quite unusual because you assume that the reason why somebody would not want their daughter to get married would be because they wanted, you know, her to marry somebody better or whatever, not for her to have a sort of a completely independent life. In a way, what he was envisaging for Clara was far more modern.
Yes.
You know, he wasn't a sort of reactionary, I want you to behave like women of old. He was essentially saying, I want you to be something that really not many women were at that point.
Yes, I think it's very important to remember that, you know, Clara was the first female concert pianist. And really at that time, apart from Liszt, there were very few people treading the boards of the concert platform as we know it today. And for a woman, of course, that was particularly extraordinary. I mean, in her lifetime, Clara did over 1,200 concerts and 40 tours outside Germany. I mean, it's a staggering amount. You know, even today, I haven't done 1,200 concerts, I'm sure. So it's. I think it's... Historically, she was so important. She travelled a lot. She had a cake named after her. She was given a special position by the emperor. She was, in her lifetime, much more famous than Schumann was. And Friedrich Wieck did not want anything in the way of that.
Well, we'll come a little bit later to how she and Robert both behaved and worked within the marriage. How did they eventually get past Friedrich to get married? What happened there? It was a big court case.
There was a big court case, and they did enlist the help of a mutual friend who said he would try and build bridges. But actually, as it turned out, by the time they went to court and the hearing came through, it was already her 21st birthday, and at this point she could marry Robert legally. So in fact, they went through all that, and then she could get married, and they did. And they managed to build some bridges afterwards.
And around this time, both before and after the marriage, he wrote an enormous amount of music, didn't he? Both piano works and songs.
During their engagement, the amount of piano music he wrote is quite staggering. And although it's not all dedicated to Clara, Clara is very much at the heart of all this music. And Schumann was obsessed with... coded messages that he has a five-note falling theme to represent the five letters in her name that goes through all his music. And he loved making plays on words and all this sort of thing. And his music at that point is full of this outpouring of love and inspiration. She was his inspiration.
And they also set up a marriage diary. Was this?
Yes, they did. When they got married, Schumann, who was very influenced by literature throughout his life and who loved to write and to read an awful lot, so that it would be a good way that they could communicate and get past the little quibbles that one has in everyday married life by writing them all down.
It's sort of, their own personal marriage counselling in a way. I mean, it's quite forward-thinking.
Very, very forward-thinking, and everything was written in this diary.
Absolutely everything. And, of course, it's a marker of how badly things start to go wrong with Schumann's declining mental health. But at the very beginning, this is the opening entry. It's all really a bed of roses, I think.
Beloved Clara, let me kiss you most tenderly on this, your first day as a wife. The first of your 22nd year. Now, this little book, which I'm inaugurating today, has a very intimate meaning. It shall be a diary about everything that touches us mutually in our household and our marriage. Our own wishes and desires shall be recorded therein. And once a week, we will swap these secretarial duties, exchanging the diary every Sunday, so that neither of us can be kept from also adding a kiss. The recording of 1 week may never amount to less than a single page, and whoever fails in this respect shall receive some sort of punishment, which we'll have to decide upon. However, the most beautiful and heartfelt content of the book, oh, my dear wife, will be your beautiful hopes and mine, which may heaven bless, your and my anxieties, which married life does bring with it. In short, all our joys and sorrows should be written down here as a true history, and in years to come, we will enjoy reading it. Now, if you agree with all of this, my darling wife, then sign your name here underneath mine. I'm truly your sincerely loving husband, Robert. Now you.
I too, your wife Clara, who is devoted to you with her entire soul, this day shall be inscribed in our book as the best and most important of my life. 1,000 kisses from your faithful bride to you, my darling Robert.
Lucy, once they were married, aside from his mental health, what were the real kind of struggles that they had to contend with? I mean, there are all sorts of things, financial and the way in which they related to one another. I mean, a lot of these come up in the marriage diaries.
Yes, when they were first married, Robert was very keen to have a wife by his side and very keen to have children. Clara, however, who was used to being a child prodigy and fated, much as she wanted these things, they came as rather a shock to her. And the daily duty, she talks a lot in the diaries about the evil of the thin walls, because she was finding it very hard to practice, very hard to do her daily composition as she'd done. I mean, her own composing at that time pretty much dried up.
And so the walls were so thin that he could hear, and she felt somehow self-conscious about practicing with
him in the house. She felt very self-conscious, yet she felt she needed to keep all her, you know, her exercises and everything up and all her playing up. And then, of course, she was still touring before she was pregnant with their first child, Mary, and Robert didn't really want her to go on tour, so this created some sort of friction. And whilst she was away, he was very unhappy and wrote a lot of letters saying, "Why haven't I heard from you?" and "Why still haven't I heard from you?" And I'm pacing around the house. He spent a lot of time getting drunk.
How conflicted was she about this? Because, I mean, actually, when you really read it, he was not easy at all. And in a sense, demanded of her an awful lot that meant that she had to give up quite a lot of her own talent, her own dreams, in a way. I mean, but how was she okay with that? Was she so deeply in love with him that it didn't really matter?
I think in the beginning she found it very, very difficult. But in fact, because she was the main breadwinner of the two of them, she did have to go back and work, and they relied very heavily upon her income, and she played whilst she was very heavily pregnant. And so Schumann had no choice really but to accept that. And the children, as they appeared, I mean, all eight of them were, you know, taken over by nannies and boarding school, and so she didn't see that much of the children. Nevertheless, she had this superhuman task of keeping her husband happy, keeping her own playing going, her teaching. I mean, she was a most extraordinarily strong and exceptional woman.
From the sort of exuberant happiness that you read in those first marriage diaries, it seems almost incredible and very, very sad that their story should have such a tragic end. Once Brahms has sort of come on the scene and was around, he sort of became a third person in their marriage in a way. And one of the most moving accounts of the final days of Schumann's life come from Brahms as well. Let's hear that. This was when Brahms visited Endenich in 1856.
At first, he lay for a long time with eyes closed, and she knelt before him, more calmly than one would believe possible. But after a while, he recognized her, and once he plainly desired to embrace her, flung one arm wide around her. Of course, he'd been unable to speak for some time already. One could understand, or perhaps one imagined one did, only some few disconnected words. And even that must have made her happy. He refused the wine that was offered him, but from her finger, he sometimes sucked it up eagerly, at such length and so passionately that one knew with certainty he recognized the finger.
I saw him again between 6 and 7 in the evening. He smiled and put his arms around me with great effort, for he can no longer control his limbs. Not all the treasures in the world could equal this embrace. I shall never forget it. It is 2.5 years since he was torn away from me without any farewell, and it was thus that we had to see each other again. He suffered dreadfully, and he often spoke vehemently. I lay silently at his feet, hardly daring to breathe. Only now and then I received a clouded look, although it was unspeakably gentle. I could only pray to God to release him, because I loved him so dearly. I stood at the body of my passionately loved husband and was calm. All my feelings were of thankfulness to God that he was finally free. Oh, if only he had taken me with him. All my happiness is over. God give me strength to live without him. Thank you.
That was Troy Murray from Kinderzinn and the Scenes of Childhood, a dreamy miniature by Schumann, played by Lucy Parham, who joined me for that Proms Plus event at the Royal College of Music, along with the actors Gabrielle Drake and Henry Goodman reading from Robert and Clara Schumann's letters. And I think there was probably not a dry eye in the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the college after that beautiful performance by Lucy. Well, that Proms Plus event was produced by Elizabeth Funning. Well, we've had the first half of tonight's prom, and you've joined me, Sarah Moore-Peach, live at the Royal Albert Hall for the second part. It was Schumann in the first half, and the pianist Christian Zacharias described the Floristan dancing waltz at the end of Schumann's piano concerto, which is a taste of things to come. A whole sequence of music by the waltz king, Johann Strauss the Younger. But we wouldn't be able to carry on with the concert without a moment to remember Sir Charles McCarris, who was due to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in tonight's concert. He sadly died earlier this month, and with him we lost an extraordinary musical force, a generous and meticulous musician, and a champion of composers like Janáček, who'd otherwise have slipped into oblivion, as well as a superlative conductor of mainstream repertoire, Mozart operas and Beethoven symphonies, to name just a couple of things. Well, earlier on today, one of the BBC Philharmonic's players, the principal bassoonist David Chatwin, described how Sir Charles's passing is a very, very sad loss. David Chatwin always looked forward to working with him, described him as very direct about what he wanted from the orchestra, but nothing was personal. He never upset anybody, and I think that must be pretty unique among conductors. He also described how playing Dvorak with Sir Charles in Prague was a wonderful experience. And Roger Wright, director of the Proms in tonight's programme, says that in his honour, we've replaced one work from tonight's advertised programme with Dvorak's touching Slavonic dance, Opus 72, number 2. Thank you. Vasily Sinaisky conducting the BBC Philharmonic in the Slavonic Dance Opus 72, number 2 in E minor, in memory of Sir Charles McCarris.
Thank you.
The overture to Die Fledermaus by the Waltz King Johann Strauss the Younger. Vasily Sinaisky bringing the BBC Philharmonic to their feet. Following on from that Dvorak tribute to Sir Charles Mackerras, a rather fitting piece to play there. Sir Charles Mackerras was the very first person to conduct the complete Die Fledermaus at the Proms in 1975. Well, continuing now with Strauss with the Thunder and Lightning Polka. Well, the Prommers were loving that, bouncing up and down in time to the Thunder and Lightning Polka. Special mention from Vasily Sinaisky, but the percussion section, he played quite a prominent role in that Strauss polka. And I think the Prommers are really going to come into their own now. Perhaps they will even waltz to the next two pieces by Johann Strauss the Younger, the so-called Waltz King of Vienna. The Emperor Waltz, followed by the beautiful Blue Danube. Thank you. the Emperor Waltz by Strauss, Vasily Sinaisky insisting that the principal cellist Peter Dixon get to his feet. He certainly brought the Royal Albert Hall to a hush with his solo in that piece. The BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Vasily Sinaisky, in the second half of tonight's prom, which continues the great prom's tradition of an evening of Viennese waltzes. And to continue now, perhaps the most famous waltz of all, the Blue Danube. by the beautiful Blue Danube, perhaps the most loved waltz sequence by Johann Strauss the Younger. The BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Vasily Sinaitsky here at the BBC Proms. I have to say I'm a little disappointed that nobody promming in the arena even tried to waltz to that, but there was plenty of bobbing up and down, and frankly there wouldn't be space to move at all. It is absolutely packed out in the arena and in the seats of the Royal Albert Hall. Well, the Prommers were clapping so well in time to that that Vasily Sinaitsky barely needed to conduct the end of the Radetzky March by the elder Johann Strauss. In fact, a few bars before the end, he wandered off and joined the brass section at the back of the stage. The BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Vasily Sinaitsky, in the second half of tonight's Prom, bringing Vienna to the Royal Albert Hall. It's a tradition which goes right the way back to the 1950s. Sir John Barbarolli and Manchester's other orchestra, the Halle, first gave an evening of Viennese waltzes in 1953. And in fact, in the same model as tonight's concert, the Viennese waltzes were all in the second half of the Prom concert. And at the first half, they had music by Schubert and others. Absolutely everybody in the Royal Albert Hall right now is smiling, is as good a tribute as you could wish for Sir Charles Mackerras. This Prom, which he was due to conduct, was played by the BBC Philharmonic and Vasily Sinaitsky in his memory. Well, the first half of this evening's concert was dedicated to the music of Schumann. It's the bicentenary of his birth this year, and there's plenty more Schumann to look forward to at the Proms. And tomorrow night, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales is launching the prom cycle of Schumann symphonies with his first symphony in B-flat, the Spring Symphony. And they're also joined by the percussionist Colin Curry, who plays A Table of Noises. It's the London premiere of a piece by Simon Holt. Well, the BBC Philharmonic making their way off stage now at the Royal Albert Hall. That's all from us here at the Proms. It's back to Katrina Young now in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Sarah. That was Sarah Moore Peach. And if you'd like a chance to, as it were, revisit that prom, you'll be able to hear it on Wednesday during Afternoon on 3, beginning at 2 o'clock. You might also want to share your thoughts about tonight's performance. If so, you can submit a review of the prom by going to bbc.co.uk/proms and clicking on Share. Well, tomorrow being Monday, as well as our evening visit to the Royal Albert Hall, there's also a lunchtime chamber music prom from Cadogan Hall. There is a slight change of programme. One of the members of Metaphor is ill, so the group appearing with the pianist Francesco Piemontese will be the Navara Quartet. And instead of the new work by Jouni Kaipainen, they'll be performing Haydn's String Quartet in G minor, Opus 20, No. 3. That's in between Preludes by Debussy and Schumann's Piano Quintet. Well, that all begins at 1 o'clock tomorrow, and then in the evening, as Sarah said, there's more Schumann, his Symphony No. 1, The Spring, launching the prom cycle of Schumann's symphonies. Tomorrow night's prom begins live on Radio 3 at 7 o'clock. And I thought we'd stay with Schumann now and some soprano duets he wrote in 1840. We begin with Wenn ich ein Vöglein wär, If I Were a Little Bird, sung by Felicity Lott and Anne Murray.
Wenn ich ein Vöglein wär und auch zwei Vöglein hätt, flög ich zu dir, flög ich zu dir. Thank you.
Mein Garten by Schumann, sung by Felicity Lott with the pianist Graham Johnson. And before that, Felicity Lott was joined by Anne Murray for three of Schumann's duets, Wenn ich ein Vöglein war, Herbstlied and Schön Blümelein.
Breakfast on Radio 3. Breakfast on Radio 3, bringing music to life. Weekday mornings from 7 till 10 here on BBC Radio 3.
That was Rob Cowan, of course, and he'll be here tomorrow morning for breakfast. Now the time is 9:15 and we come to Drama on 3, Between Two Worlds by Adrian Bean and David Hendy. It's a new play commissioned by Radio 3 and based on the life of Sir Oliver Lodge, a strange and forgotten figure from the Edwardian era, establishment scientist, unacknowledged inventor of radio, dabbler in psychic phenomena, and the friend of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Albert Einstein. Long before Marconi's triumphs with radio telegraphy, Lodge demonstrated wireless transmission of signals in a Royal Institution lecture in 1894. But his real passion was for proving the existence of the ether, which was proving elusive. Lodge also became obsessed with telepathy and eventually joined the Society of Psychical Research. He was married to Mary and they had 12 children. Before Sir Oliver Lodge died, he placed three sealed envelopes, what he called a posthumous packet, in a box which was kept at the Society of Psychical Research. 14 years after his death, the Society were to employ a medium to communicate with the spirit of Sir Oliver and find out what was in the envelopes. This way they could prove once and for all that Lodge's memory had survived death and he was able to communicate from beyond the grave. The experiment was conducted in 1954. Oliver Lodge is played by Owen Teal, Mary Lodge by Amanda Root, and Raymond Lodge by Sandy Grierson in Drama on 3, Between Two Worlds.
Death is not something to fear, any more than birth is.
Is there anybody there?
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women.
We change our state at birth and come into the world of air and sense and myriad existence.
Is anyone there?
We change our state at death and enter a region of what? Of ether, I think, and still more myriad existence.
5 minutes.
A region in which communion is more akin to what we here call telepathy. A region in which beauty and knowledge are as vivid as they are here. A region in which progress is possible, and in which admiration, hope, and love are even more real and dominant. It is in this sense that we can truly say, the dead are not dead, but alive.
10 seconds.
Raymond, my boy, are you there?
Is there anyone?
We've been experimenting throughout the week.
Is there anybody?
Broadcasting from the air.
Is there anybody there? Is there anybody there? Is there anybody there?
Let the record note the date, May the 22nd, 1954. Professor Lodge, our esteemed medium, Mrs. Lawrence, will communicate with you and endeavour to tell us what to expect to discover when we open the envelopes.
Is there anybody there? Is it Professor Lodge?
Good.
These gentlemen from the society want you to help them.
Very well. Let us proceed to the first envelope.
I see a word. It's unclear. And a picture. There's a large building. White building. And a bird. Two birds on the roof. We're near the sea. Many tall ships.
A port.
It,
and the word?
It's becoming clearer. I see an L. V, I think. Yes, a P. Liverpool.
Liverpool?
Is that the word you're communicating, Professor?
It must be. It's where Lodge made his name in science.
Yes.
Let us open the envelope. Oh, Marymont.
What a lovely name, Marymont.
The previous owner named it. So, Mrs. Lodge, Lodge children, all of you, come on, reports please.
We love it, Papa.
We love it, Mama.
We could play it here.
I like it.
Perfect, Ollie. Thank you. What do you think, Raymond?
Splendid, Ma. Good choice, Pa.
Thank you. We're of one mind, Raymond, you and I. One mind.
I liked our house in Liverpool.
Really? Birmingham's really just as fine a city as Liverpool. And we have far more room in this house, Honor.
Which is as it should be. Your father has standing now. It's the sort of house one should expect for the principal of a university.
I admit it does have a certain ring to it. Well, the new principal has finished his rounds for today. Come on, you lot, follow me. Mary, please.
Dear Oliver, Lady Lodge.
Thank you, Harrison. Children!
Oh, leave them, Ollie. They're excited.
Do you really like it?
Ollie, how many times? It's perfect. I know we'll be happy here.
It has a good feeling, don't you think?
Yes, yes. It's a happy house.
Radio telegraphy. Isn't that Marconi's invention? Sent a message across the Atlantic.
My husband is developing his own theories on radio telegraphy, aren't you, Oliver?
Oh, you don't want to bore our guests with all that, my dear.
Oh, not at all, Professor. I think science is fascinating. Now, if anyone can explain, you can. What are electromagnetic waves?
Well, they're all around us, in the air, in this very room, even now. They're ridiculously easy to produce. It happens whenever a condenser or even any conductor is discharged, causing a spark. The trouble is in detecting them. I'm not going too fast, am I?
Oh, no, no, please. It's fascinating.
I remember Oliver gave the most tremendous lecture where the wallpaper of the lecture theatre was covered with flakes of metal representing foliage. And during the experiments on the lecture table, the wallpaper actually began to sparkle.
Aristotle said there could not be an empty space. Well, I firmly believe space is full of a substance subtler than air, weightless and transparent, mysterious, the ether. And as sound needs air or the waves of the sea need water in order to travel, the electromagnetic waves need the ether. But I'm not here to talk of the ether, but of how to create waves and how to detect them. Are you ready, Mr. Davis?
Ready, Professor.
Excellent. Close the doors. We now have a double stone wall between us. So, if you please, quiet. Please. Can someone knock on the door? Our signal to Mr. Davis. A signal is coming through. Anyone in the audience read more?
It's the letter S.
It is. There was no physical connection whatsoever between Mr. Davis and me. And yet, Mr. Davis passed the letter S to me. Or rather, Mr. Davis cast the letter S adrift in the ether so that it was all around us in this room. I simply captured it with my wave detector. This is a new kind of telegraphy, gentlemen. What we might call wireless telegraphy.
What a show. People were talking about it for days.
It wasn't a show, Mary. It was a scientific lecture before a very learned audience.
It was exciting.
Well, I suppose it was. In a way, an infantile form of radio telegraphy, but it proved that it was possible.
Lord Rayleigh was there. He was tremendously excited about the potential of Oliver's work. A way of allowing people to communicate through the ether.
Really?
Well.
Tremendous potential, he said.
Mary, I think perhaps we should talk about something else.
A name to be made.
And money as well. Plenty of it, I'm sure. Well, I'm also sure that Signor Marconi is more interested in fame than I am. So perhaps we should leave him to try and make a good living from my little wireless trick. I, on the other hand, have my scientific studies to pursue.
Talking to dead people. Honor would now like to play for you, Mrs. Kennedy.
Thought of all those voices flying around in the ether, like some sort of Tower of Babel. I can't imagine how anyone could see any use in that.
Lady Lodge said something about talking to dead people. What did she mean by that?
Oh, nothing. I'm afraid my wife thinks there are some aspects of my study which are less worthwhile than others. Children asleep.
They're exhausted. Sleeping the sleep of the dead.
Listen.
I can't hear anything.
It's a quiet house.
I'm tired.
I'm sorry, Mary.
Please don't.
I had a letter from James today.
James who?
William James, professor at Harvard. He's discovered a new medium, a woman.
Oh, Oliver.
Oh, no, listen. He says he's persuaded of this Mrs. Piper's honesty and believes her to be in possession of a power as yet unexpected.
I don't believe you. I mean, not content with embarrassing me in front of our guests at the dinner table.
I think it was you who embarrassed me.
Oliver, you know my feelings about your spiritualist stuff and nonsense. All that mystery and tapping and voices and touching. I mean, it's a parlour game, and it's a little sordid.
Professor James is in no doubt. He's a world authority on the science of psychology.
I don't care about Professor James. We agreed. No more mediums.
But if I can carry out some experiments with Mrs. Piper, I can prove once and for all...
What, Oliver? These people are charlatans, confidence tricksters. What can you possibly learn from them?
You don't understand.
No, I don't understand why you have a perfectly good subject to focus on, one which everyone thinks will actually earn you some money and a modest reputation, and you want to waste your time on that lot.
There are scientists all over the world, scientists of reputation, who are only just beginning to understand the mysteries of the spirit world. They do not think I am wasting my time. They appreciate the work I am doing.
But
But wireless?
Wireless is a fascinating prospect. But how much more amazing is it to open the door to another world? A world where the spirits of people from previous ages can communicate with us and tell us truly wonderful things.
I thought we'd left all this behind when we left Liverpool.
Professor William James is held in the highest regard by the Society for Psychical Research. We shall be most interested in the results of your experiments with Mrs. Piper.
I want to be absolutely sure that there's no possibility of collusion or muscle reading, Professor Myers.
I'm sure you will control for that.
Thank you.
It's not just writers and dreamers in the Society Lodge, but men of science. Men like you. Let me read this letter from the Reverend Frederick Barker at this very university. At about 11 o'clock on the night of December the 6th, 1873, I had just got into bed when I suddenly startled my wife by a deep groan, and when she asked the reason, I said, I have just seen my aunt. She came and she stood beside me and smiled with her old kind smile and disappeared. Within a week of this vision, this impression, the Reverend learned that she died on that very night. And what is more, this much-loved aunt was calling out for the Reverend as she passed.
A death is an emotional time for all concerned.
Of course. Nothing proved by that. But what about poor Mrs. Wright from Nottingham, who one bright May morning saw her dear young daughter appear like a flash of lightning in her own backyard at the very moment, the little girl was in fact being crushed to death under the wheels of a baker's cart on the other side of town.
Merely anecdotal.
The Society has about 700 more, just like that, all describing the same thing, a kind of distant apparition or feeling at the moment of death of another.
I'm sorry, Professor Myers, but this is the stuff of ghost stories. You're conjuring phantoms and then building fantasies out of them.
If sound and light can travel through the ether without wires, why not energy of all kinds? I know you believe thought transference might be possible, Lodge. Indeed, you have performed experiments already.
Hardly.
Consciousness does extend beyond the brain.
Steady, Myers. Steady. I certainly haven't shown anything is a fact. You're leaping to conclusions.
And if consciousness extends beyond the brain, beyond the body, then it's surely also capable of surviving the moment of death. It need not be snuffed out.
Myers, I am a man of science. I study the mysterious, the unknown, but I do not dabble in ghosts and spirits. This is not supernatural. It is just another part of the natural world that we haven't yet grasped.
I'm trying to write a report and it's like living in bedlam. Right, that's enough.
Ollie?
I'll give you plain. These are going where they go.
We're fighting the Battle of Waterloo.
In the garden.
Please, my soldiers.
Now, I don't want to hear another word from you. Not a sound. Understand?
Yes.
Is that really necessary?
Raymond. Oh, Raymond, I'm sorry.
She's here. Mrs. Piper?
Yes.
Oliver Locke. Welcome to Birmingham, Mrs. Piper. My son will take your bags. Raymond.
Allow me.
Thank you, Professor.
Come in! Come in! Oh, Raymond, you'll catch your death.
I'm fine, Ma.
Oh, what a lovely house. They're all here.
Who are all here?
Spirits.
Mrs. Piper, I'm sorry to ask, but would you mind opening your bag?
Excuse me.
Explain, Oliver.
I shall need to look inside all your cases, Mrs. Piper, to see if you have any books of mine or newspaper articles, anything that tells you something about me.
I see.
It is simply a precaution.
Against fraud.
I see.
You'll also notice there are no photographs or portraits of the family anywhere in the house.
Along with all our scrapbooks and letters, all cleared away for your visit as a precaution. There can be no telegrams, communication with the outside world, I'm afraid, Mrs. Piper. Absolutely none. You and I have to concentrate on the business at hand. Communication with the other world.
Right. Everything seems to be ready down here. Well, what do you think, Mary?
About what?
About Mrs. Piper. She seems to be a respectable woman. Perfectly normal.
They all do, Oliver.
I feel a lot of force here.
Are you sure she's all right?
Perfectly normal. She's summoning her control. Inviting him to enter her.
Now what?
She's in a trance. Watch when I prick her with this needle. See? She doesn't feel a thing.
Who disturbs Dr. Fenwick? What is the purpose? There are friends here who wish to speak to dear ones on the other side. First, I have a message for you. There are vibrations in the ether, and those who have ears to listen will heed the warning.
I must say that was truly odd.
Wasn't it just, Mary? Did you get it all down in your notes, Raymond?
I think so. She was awfully fast, Father.
I'll go through them now. In my study.
What is past midnight, dear?
I need to work while the details are still fresh. Good night, Mary. Night, Raymond.
Ma.
Yes, Raymond.
Don't tell me you actually believe in this nonsense, Mother.
No. She was convincing, though. How on earth could she possibly have known my father gave this locket to me when I was born? And how could she have known?
A lucky guess. She's clever.
She did warn us that something big and terrifying is about to happen.
Oh, bravo for her. I'm sure she reads the papers, Ma. And you know the papers are full of catastrophe just now. It's not Ireland, it's the dreadnoughts, or spies, or the Kaiser looking for a fight. Mrs. Piper has the law of averages on her side. I'm surprised at Father being taken in by her. He likes hard facts, he's a scientist.
This is because he's a scientist. He's so open to possibilities. He's a naive. Sometimes, Raymond, I think he's our child. Promise you'll write every day.
Raymond's fighting for king and country and not going on holiday, Mary.
Of course I'll write, Ma, whenever I can.
I have to go.
Oh, one last kiss.
Goodbye. Goodbye, old man.
And good luck.
Thank you.
We... what I mean...
I really must...
Yes, yes, of course.
We'll be thinking of you.
every hour.
Goodbye!
Goodbye!
Keep in constant touch.
Don't forget us!
There, there, my love. He'll be fine, you'll see. He will be fine. He's a brave lad. They all are.
I know.
He's sensible. Mary. He's quick. He's clever. We'll be proud of him, and he'll come back to us. He'll come back to us. He'll be fine.
April 1915, 1:15 p.m. Dearest Father, a glorious starry sky with a very young and inexperienced moon. Quite dry and warm. I'm writing this in my dugout and I've just had a shave. I've got my little Primus with me. I'll look out for the great sunrise tomorrow morning and I'm wishing you all a jolly good Easter. I shan't have at all a bad one. It's very like Robinson Crusoe. We treasure up our supplies and have excellent meals off limited and simple rations. I sleep like a top and I'm absolutely comfortable. On Monday and Wednesday, we dug trenches by night. We were only about 300 yards from the enemy, but we had a most peaceful time. Only a very few stray bullets whistling over from time to time. There's a strange thrill when they come close. That describes the feeling best, I think. A kind of excitement. I'm having quite a nice time, really. I'm awfully grateful for all the things that have been sent and attach a list of wants. A periscope with spare mirrors and a star map.
That would be excellent. Cabbages, apples, some dates or figs, kippers. He makes it sound like he's having a lovely time.
It all sounds horrible. My only consolation is that I feel he's being protected. Don't you?
Yes. Yes, of course. Absolutely.
Wednesday, 12th of May, 1915. Dearest Father, I'm not making things out better than they really are. We have our unpleasant moments, shelling and so on, but no very bad times as yet. And the less one worries about it, the less there is. When I arrived, I found everyone suffering from nerves and unwilling to talk about shells at all. Now I understand why. The other day, a shrapnel burst near our billet caught one of our servants. He lost the fingers of his right hand, and I have been trying to forget the mess it made of his right leg. He will have had it amputated by now. I wonder if you can get hold of some morphia tablets for wounded men. These tablets can be placed in the mouth to relieve pain. They might prove very useful because if a man is hit in the morning, he will usually have to wait until dark to be removed.
Ollie, you must send some morphia.
I'll do what I can, Mary.
It was raining. The ground was very slippery, and it was the darkest night I can remember. There was a good deal of liveliness, too. There were about 100 of us in our party. Picture us shuffling our way across the fields at about 1 mile an hour. Wire or debris of some sort. We crouched down to try and miss the bullets. Every few minutes, a very light will go up, and the whole line freezes and remains absolutely stationary in its tracks until the light goes out. Your loving son, Raymond.
A fairy light?
Very. With a V. Listen.
It is just a bright starlight with a little parachute attached. The light lasts about 5 seconds. Sometimes dozens are in the air together, especially if an attack is on. They fall slowly through the air.
You're very distant tonight, Oliver. Is there something?
I wasn't going to tell you, but...
But what, Oliver? What is it?
A letter from Professor James.
Yes?
Mrs. Piper was having a sitting in America, and out of the blue my name was mentioned, in connection with the word Faunus.
Faunus?
Yes, Faunus. I'm not an expert, Mary, but they drummed a little of the classics into me when I was at school. So I knew straight away it was from Horace. He wrote in one of his odes about Faunus protecting the poets.
Well, why on earth would Mrs. Piper mention Horace?
Well, I'm not sure. But I looked it up. Horace wrote about a narrow escape from death when a falling tree just missed him, and that it was Faunus who somehow intervened to save him from the blow. Me, the cursed trunk that smote my skull, had slain. But Faunus, strong to shield the friends of Mercury, checked the blow in mid-descent.
I don't know what to make of it. Do you?
I'm not sure what I think of it. It's just that it came up in connection with my name. The message was that Lodge would understand.
Are you worried, dear?
Not worried. Perhaps, though, it's telling me that something is going to happen. Some sort of blow. I'm sure it won't be anything serious. Something to do with work. Financial, probably. Perhaps I ought to check the books tomorrow, see if I can make a connection.
Yes. Well, if it means anything, it means that we'll be protected from disaster. That Faunus will save us.
Yes. Of course.
This waiting. Not knowing. I have a hole in my heart and shall have until Raymond, dear Raymond, comes back.
Mary!
I'm coming!
Mary, a letter!
Oh, don't you dare open it!
Dearest Ma and Pa, the mess was thrown into the greatest state of excitement yesterday by the arrival of Kippers. Splendid. Thank you, we had a grand breakfast this morning. Quite like the summer holidays again. Breakfast after a bathe, with Alec, of course.
Oh, you've opened it!
He's all right, Mary.
Oh, God.
Mary, please, he's fine. Don't you see?
I'm sorry, it's just worse when he sounds so happy.
I know that it is hard for you at home.
It sounds like Raymond then.
Waiting, not knowing. Mustn't worry, either of you. Imagine I'm with you, Ma, at the table, in the garden, in the house, in another room. The men here are fond of the story about the angels at Mons, which you've no doubt read about in the newspapers at home. Every now and then, someone will swear to having seen a strange mist, strange lights, ghostly figures watching over them. The trenches are full of prophecies and legends and visions, stuff and nonsense as far as I can make out. But even the officers have reported seeing by their side men they know to be dead. We all have our charms and keepsakes which we cling to. It's silly, I know, but we'll come to certain harm without them. The army chaplain here, McFadgen, has a small crumpled picture of the Madonna and Christ, which he pins on the wall of his dugout whenever he tries to hold a service. But mostly it's other things. Bullets, postcards, drawings and photographs, even the odd bag of English soil. I have my book of poetry, which Alex sent. I've also got a German rifle, not exactly a lucky charm, but it's finders keepers. And the captain's got a helmet, a dirty thing. He had to have it cleaned out because part of the owner was still inside it.
So restful here. I'm glad we got away. Look,
Look, Papa, look at this shell.
Let me see. My, my, that's a beauty. Will you take this shell home? And whenever you hold it to your ear, you'll be able to hear the sea. And you'll never forget this moment.
Dearest Ma and Pa, it's like a long picnic in all sorts of different places with a sort of constraint and uneasiness in the air. One starts to get depressed and moody. Cheero. It's lovely weather. Great spirits. Goodbye. Much love. Raymond.
I do love the kite. Raises the spirit.
So, what would you like to do today? Another walk along the beach?
Perhaps. I'm still tired. I didn't sleep very well.
Another headache, Papa?
No. A dream of sorts.
We'll get up later, get some air.
Mr. Lodge, sir?
Oh, no more toast, thank you.
A telegram, sir. Would sir like to take it in the drawing room?
No. No, thank you, that won't be necessary. It's from the War Office.
Oh, Ollie.
I deeply regret. Second Lieutenant R. Lodge, 2nd South Lancashire. Lord Kitchener expresses his sympathy.
Morning, sir, madam. Lunch is served in the dining car.
Hungry, my dear.
No.
Thank you, we shan't be done. Oh, Mary. Mary, darling. So, having heated this rod with an electrical charge, we need to turn down the lights. If you please. Thank you. Now I'm going to place the heated rod in the beam of this bright light. Thus. And what do we observe? Sir, what do you see?
Steam!
No.
The rod appears to be burning. Smoke?
Well, let's have a look. Yes, we can observe what appears to be smoke. Just above the dark rod. A rather dark smoke, too. And yet, lights, please. There, no smoke. What we saw was not black smoke, but the illusion of black smoke. Now, why should this be? Well, think of when you see a beam of light entering a dark room. You are, in fact, not seeing a beam of light at all. You are seeing merely the dust which that beam illuminates. Now, a few seconds ago, the heat of this small object in front of me momentarily cleared away the dust just next to it. And without that dust, the light could not be scattered. It just went past the rod without us noticing, indeed giving to us the appearance of dark smoke, when in fact it was dark space. My modest experiment this evening is a warning. There is something beyond that which is visible. That, too, must be explored. We must attend, ladies and gentlemen, to what our senses cannot apprehend, and then, perhaps, its mysteries will be unlocked. Thank you.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Alec?
Yes, Honor.
They know where our brother's buried?
Yes. A cemetery near the aid post. Somewhere on the Ypres Menin Road. It's in a garden next to a ruined farmhouse. He's under some tall trees. It sounds very peaceful.
He's dead, Ollie. Our son is dead. If only I could see him. Might make it more believable somehow.
Please, Mary.
I keep expecting him to walk through the door. To feel his arms around me.
Is there anybody there?
Mrs. Lawrence, are you ready for the second stage of the experiment?
I think so, yeah.
Second envelope, please. As before, I shall ask... Are you well? Some water?
No! No, please! It's started. The image is coming through so strongly.
What is it?
I can see a number of faces. Two, three rows of men. All smiling. I think they're in... Yeah, they're wearing uniform.
Is it the Raymond photograph?
I don't understand.
A photograph taken of Raymond at the front. A crucial piece of...
Yes. The professor says that's it.
Let's open the envelope. Oh. Does anybody read music?
Let me see.
Does that mean anything to anybody? Sir Oliver... Mrs. Kennedy's waiting.
Oh. Mary, it's Catherine.
Catherine? Oh, yes. Catherine, of course. Yes. Yes, bring her in.
Please. Catherine.
Sir Oliver, Mary, I'm so very sorry. I simply don't know what to say.
Please, sit down. We are at least all together now. The children are here. Alec arrived yesterday.
I'm so sorry.
Lionel, Nora. The others will be here soon.
We're a comfort to each other. I'm sure you found it so when you heard about your dear Paul.
Yes, very much so. Oliver, Mary, I have, I think, a little more comfort to offer. It's something strange. I hope you won't think this is the wrong time.
Please.
Well, as you know, Oliver, since Paul died, I've been... Well, it began just after, just a day or so after, I can't remember. It was the strangest thing. I suddenly felt obliged to hold a pencil and I began to receive writing. Automatic writing I can't control. First, Paul's name. I asked him questions. He answered yes or no at first. But since then...
Go on.
Since then, if I...
sit down and think of him. Gently, you know, but concentrating. The garden is best. Then he comes through. I find myself writing pages and pages every day.
This is Paul?
Oliver, I'm not sure. But yes, I feel it's him. It's so much like him. Oh, I have doubt, of course. It's not always easy to read, but when I decipher it, it expresses such intense sadness about my lack of belief, as if he's there, trying to convince me so strongly of his existence.
It sounds very much as if you've been able to feel something of your son's presence. You must be grateful for that small mercy in your time of sadness.
I didn't call to... There's something else. A message I received through him.
Go on.
Well, I have it here.
Go on. Don't be nervous.
I've seen that boy. Oliver's son. He's better. And he's had a splendid rest, tell his people.
Oliver.
I shall bring Raymond to his father when he comes. Sorry. He's so jolly. Everyone loves him. He's found heaps of his own folks here.
Oh, please go here. People only knew how we longed to come. They would all call us. Do tell his mother and father.
Please, Mother. Mother, sit down.
Raymond's trying to get through, Oliver. He's trying to get through. To let you know he hasn't gone. Paul. Others on that side of the veil. I think they're trying to find a way through. To bring him to you.
G-H-I-I. A-B. Was that A? A. A-B-C. The letter D. I am Raymond.
Raymond?
It's simpler for them if they only have to send a yes or no.
Oh, I see. Of course. Yes. I understand. Raymond? Are you lonely?
No.
It's Mother, Raymond. Your father's here, too. Have you got a message for us?
Yes.
What is it, Raymond? Raymond? Raymond?
It's too complicated for the table, madam. I think he's only just learning how to use it.
Can you get him through to us another way, Mrs. Leonard?
Perhaps Fedder.
Fedder?
Her spirit guide. Shh. She's slipping into a trance. Mrs. Leonard, is Fedder there?
I feel fear of you. We go deeper. We go deeper.
It is not the first time she has come back.
It is Feda. I'm here.
Feda, do you have Raymond with you?
There is someone here. A young man.
What does he look like, Feda?
Young. About 25. His hair is between colours. A fine shaped head. Just an outline. Not fully built up yet. In this world. He's not been over here long, but he holds himself up well. He's been waiting for you. Try to give me a letter. Feda has a letter R.
Oh, Mrs. Lennon, Feda, can you tell us what Raymond is doing? What are you doing, Raymond?
He didn't know if he was going to cope when he waked up first, but now he is happier because... I know I can. I know that as soon as I am a little more ready, I have a great deal of work to do. I'll be helping at the front. Not the wounded, but helping those who are passing over in the war. He knows that when they pass on and wake up, they still feel afraid. They don't always believe they've passed on. They don't know where they are. And he explains to them and helps them and soothes them.
Good Lord. Raymond, my dear boy.
I was worried at first, but now I feel splendid. He wants so much to make it clear to those left behind that he's all right and that they're not to worry about him. There's a whole group of people helping. And an important message for Father, for science. Not only is the partition so thin that you can hear the operators on the other side, but a big hole has been made.
Can you tell us anything to show it is really you, Raymond? I do so strongly want scientific proof. You know that, don't you?
Raymond?
Raymond is thinking. It is hard.
You have photographs of me.
Yes. Yes, Raymond, we have two lovely portraits of you at home. In your uniform, don't we, Oliver?
Oh.
No, not those. He's in a group of other men. And he's particular that I should tell you this.
I have my walking stick.
Raymond, I don't remember.
Can you describe it exactly? Absolutely exactly, Raymond.
Somebody wanted to lean on me. At the back lines going down. A mixed lot.
Thank you, Raymond. And...
Raymond's feeling tired now. Raymond says that he likes talking to you, Mother. But Father asks too many questions. He says Father will frighten Feda, and then Father will not get anything. He says Father mustn't bother him with test questions until he is better. He finds it easier to talk to you, Madam. He calls you Mother. He says that you must come back. It needs a medium. With Feda, he sees you quite clearly.
He sees me?
Yes, he is here. But it is difficult to get near.
I feel your hand on mine, Raymond.
It is my hand, Mother.
Feda's going now. Raymond wants to go too. Come on, Raymond. Raymond's tired.
You must rest now, I understand. One of your big sleeps. Goodbye, Raymond. My Raymond, darling.
Goodbye, old man. We'll hear from you again, won't we?
Goodbye, Soliver.
Goodbye, Soliver.
That was quite astonishing. Quite astonishing. We need more proof, though, don't we? You know, just to be absolutely sure, we should go to other mediums, perhaps. See if Raymond can get through to us with them. Test them on family matters they couldn't know. And
Oliver!
What?
Stop! This isn't one of your experiments.
Of course not. I'm sorry.
Oh, Ollie, it's true. It's true, isn't it? It's him. You sense that too.
Yes. Yes, Mary, I believe it's him.
I thought he'd gone. Raymond, darling, you have gone from the world to ease the pain. I want to know if you are happy, and that you yourself are really talking to me, and no sham. No more letters from you, my own dear son. I have loved them so. I have not seen as much of you as I wanted on this earth.
I trust her, Alec. She was giving us information that was quite beyond anything she could know about.
But she got so many things wrong. Raymond's description, the eye colour was wrong. He was 26, not 25.
You don't understand. When Mrs. Leonard communicates with Feda, and when Feda speaks to Raymond, it's just as likely to get a little muddled as it is when two wireless operators are trying to connect. It breaks down every now and then.
And don't forget that Raymond is struggling to use this new way of sending messages. I mean, everything is so new to him.
Oh, Mama.
We've lost Raymond's body, but we haven't lost Raymond. He wants to communicate with us.
Across the ether.
And if that is so, we must listen to him. I believe it is love that breaches the chasm between our world and his.
You're saying Raymond hasn't died? He has, Papa. I'm sorry, but he's dead. He's not with us. He's buried in the earth, in an unmarked grave, on a roadside in Belgium.
Honor, please.
It's all right, Mary. Honor, I understand. Death is real. It's grievous. But his death at the front was just the end of a stage. It wasn't the end of his journey. And he's telling us, his own family, here and now, very clearly that we should be resolute. Not paralysed with grief.
Resolute? Oh, dear God, Papa. Why don't you just come out with it? You're saying we should celebrate. Be glad of his death. How can you think like that?
That's not what I'm thinking at all, Alec. Absolutely not. It's just that your mother and I, we've stopped weeping for him because he's not gone. And we can be proud of him each new day. His war work is by no means over. He's entered a new, a different region of service now. We realize he's got a purpose, and he's ingenious. We have hopes for the future.
Our life was darkened when we learned about Raymond's death, but now it's been lightened again.
I'm sorry. This is all just too much.
Honor, darling.
Let her go. Mama, I want to feel the same way too. We both do. But how can we be sure that this woman isn't a fraud?
Because I know. I was speaking to Raymond.
I was thinking about Raymond.
Yes.
It's about when he died. What do you think happens? At the moment. I mean...
Nobody knows. How can we know until we experience it for ourselves?
Do you think he was in pain?
I hope not.
This is the shell I found on Cullen Beach. The day before we heard about Raymond. You said that if I put it to my ear, I'd hear the sea. I'll never forget that day.
It's true. Try.
Your turn.
Father.
Raymond.
What?
Nothing. It was nothing. Mary!
Oliver! Oliver!
What? Mary. Mary. What is it? Are you hurt?
No, look! Look! It came with the post, look!
My God. A photograph. Three rows of British Army officers.
We're out of doors.
In front of a hut of some sort.
See my stick?
Look! Raymond's holding a stick, just as he said.
Somebody wanted to lean on me.
As Raymond described it.
We mustn't get carried away. When was this taken?
The negative plate was received by the photographic company on 15th of October.
And we sat with Mrs. Leonard at the end of September. More than 2 weeks before this arrived in the country. My God, it's proof, Mary. Proof.
Proof of what?
Proof that Raymond is helping us from the other side. Proof that there is genuine communication between the spirit world and this. I knew it.
But, Papa, this woman is very clever. She could have contacts in the photographic companies. When these photographs arrive for developing, all they have to do is furnish her with a few insignificant details which appear to be solid evidence to someone like you.
Someone like me?
I'm sorry. I don't mean...
Well, what do you mean? That I am a gullible fool, blinded by sentiment and grief, desperate to believe any old thing Mrs. Leonard tells me?
She didn't say that. But I fear, Papa, that you simply notice the descriptions that are true and you neglect those that are all wrong.
I am a man of science, not some idiot who believes there are fairies at the bottom of his garden.
Of course. I only...
I think you have said enough, both of you.
Sorry, Papa. Come on, Alec.
They mean well, Ollie. Where are you going?
My study. I have work to do. Hello? Mary? Honor? Is that you? What was that?
Father.
Who is it? Who's there? Is someone playing a game?
It's me, Father.
Raymond? Is it you? Raymond?
Father,
It's me.
Raymond. Raymond.
I'm sorry to disturb you.
Oh, dearest boy, we can talk.
I know your heart is bleeding. You never thought you could love so deeply. You're crucified. But you'll arise, stronger, bigger, better man. Out of this suffering, you're going to help humanity.
I understand.
There's work to do, Father. You and I together.
Fedder said something of the sort.
In my world, I have to fight to teach the others. The poor chaps come over before anyone's told them what'll happen. They're frightened when they feel so alive. Yet their people in your world just keep sobbing. The people on your side must learn that it is all right. They can still be with us.
But I can tell them.
Can you? When you've got so much work to do?
That can wait. But how?
With evidence. Solid, hard evidence. Like the photograph. Evidence that coming from you, with your reputation as a man of science, will sweep all ignorance into dust.
Do you think so?
You and me, Father. We'll work together to prove that I'm here. We'll burst the dam that people have set up between the two worlds. You must throw your whole life into this work. Promise me, Father.
I promise.
Don't be sad, Father. It's Christmas soon.
But it won't be the same.
I'll be with you. At the table. In the house. In another room. Put out a chair for me.
Of course.
There'll be thousands and thousands of us back in our homes at Christmas. Some of the fellows won't have a chair.
Oh, a dear scarf and gloves. They're beautiful, Ollie.
Merry Christmas, Mary.
And what is this?
You'll never guess.
Oh, please, Alec.
Hang on.
What is it?
This is very strange.
Yes?
Before he went to France, Raymond asked me what I wanted for Christmas. And I said I wanted a rattle. Did he tell you?
No. The thought just came into my head.
Ollie.
Yes, my dear.
Do you see, Alec? Raymond is with us.
I suppose he is. Merry Christmas, Raymond.
Merry Christmas.
Is there anybody there? Is there anybody there? We should be so pleased if anyone could. We've been sitting here so very patiently.
Perhaps not tonight, my dear.
Perhaps not.
Wait. I think there is something. My hands are tingling.
Raymond, darling. Raymond, is that you? Raymond? Oh, Raymond, it is you!
Merry Christmas, Raymond.
Merry Christmas, Mother.
Oh, it's so wonderful to have you here. Must you go?
I'll always be here with you. Always.
Mary, you look sad all of a sudden. Are you tired?
No, just thinking.
Tell me.
Well, if we'd never seen Mrs. Leonard, do you think Raymond would still be waiting for us? On the other side? All alone?
I don't know. All I know is that we did find him. And he found us.
Oh, but if we hadn't found each other. Oh, Ollie, it's just too painful.
I know. Raymond and I have a plan. A book which will tell the whole world what has happened since he
a
came
book?
Into our... Telling our story. How we met Raymond, what he tells
but,
us.
But that's private.
It doesn't need to be. And think what a story it would be. If I can present the world with all that has happened to us, the picture will be clear.
But, Ollie, it's also very personal. I can't even make sense of it myself. What on earth will the world think?
If we're careful, it will make sense, Mary. It's bound to be sentimental. That won't be easy for us, for me especially. But the reward, Mary, the comfort it'll give all those other poor people who are grieving, that comfort surely must outweigh the scorn.
A story to touch people.
A story to change people's minds. Think of it, Mary. If I've established the survival of one single ordinary individual, I've established it for all. This could be the most important work of my life. A whole new branch of science.
Boy, my son, the youngest, Raymond, was the most like myself at the same age. In bodily appearance, I recognized the likeness to my early self, as preserved in old photographs. And innumerable small mental traits in the boy recalled to me my childhood's feelings. Being so desperately busy all my life, I had failed to see as much as I should like, either of him or of the other boy. There was always an instinctive sympathy between us. He has entered another region of service now.
The Raymond book. I bump into it everywhere. It's not the Lord I recognize, nor the idea of judgment I acknowledge. The judgment we must all face when we die, the trials we must face on this earth.
I have walked back through the streets of London or across Fitzroy Square with a sense of unreality in everything around. So that the square and its railings, the houses, the carts and the people seemed like shadowy unreality. Phantasmal appearances. I suppose that some still intenser experience of the kind was intended by St. Paul's phrase, caught up into the third heaven.
Do not engage with forces of which you know nothing. We cannot comprehend the infinite. It lies beyond a veil we cannot choose to tear down. This idea that everything will be fair in death. No, there is heaven and there is hell. And tampering with that belief is a temptation of Satan.
When Sir Oliver Lodge, in his book, This Ghost Story, talks of strange events and communications, we must surely think of them as imposterous.
Oh, Alec, not at the breakfast table, please.
How can Sir Oliver, how can any of us, be sure that the words delivered by some medium are those of the son for whose death they so naturally grieve? Why may they not be the utterances of agencies intending to deceive? Agencies evil in themselves and intending evil to those with whom they're brought into contact.
I think we should cancel our subscription to the Times, Papa.
It's all right, Honour. I know that there have been mediums who have done little to protect their reputation, but Mrs. Leonard is a quiet woman of common sense and great integrity. She's quite beyond reproach.
It's true. She has the highest motives. As do you.
And for every one of these scurrilous letters in the papers, I have 100 more that come to me here, that speak of the comfort my book has brought.
People are laughing.
Let them laugh.
There is a great disposition in mediums to embellish a little. They can't help carry things a little too far and make stuff up. I know that. But a lot of trivial nonsense doesn't disprove anything. Some people still think that wireless telegraphy is magic. A few years ago, hearing voices in the air with no body attached to them, people would have imagined it was the exercise of some vile power. And they were wrong, Alec. Anyway, you know that we've always heard a great deal from Raymond, that we know to be true, that we know to be him. What right did I have to pick and choose which of our experiences were right and which were wrong? All the evidence must be published. Always. Always.
Alec, I was looking through Raymond's letters to Mama and Papa, and he mentions you.
What does he say?
Alec has very kindly had the motor and auto car sent me. Aren't I young? I have thought about him. Every day since he died.
Yes. I think about him a lot too.
It's so odd. But I feel I know him better now he's dead than when he was alive. I can really think about him. Who he was. What he was. There's so much I'd like to ask him. Now.
I'm sure Mrs. Leonard would oblige.
She means well. She's not a bad woman. You know that Mama and Papa would give anything to have Raymond back. Anything.
We all would. But I don't like their methods. And I don't like Feda. It makes me uneasy. The influence Mrs. Leonard has over Mama and Papa. There are grieving parents all over the country. They'd all love to see their sons again. And then, with a little bit of money, it's a new kind of priesthood honour. They change knocking and tapping into words and phantoms instead of changing water into wine.
Even if it is a trick, perhaps it doesn't matter. Look at Mama and Papa. They're comforted. They're not happy. How could they be? But since seeing Mrs. Leonard, they've been... It's all Mama's got. You've heard how she's been. We all need Raymond. Or the memory of him. We find comfort in different ways. We find Raymond in different places.
We'll use the small wicker table tonight. Raymond seems to like that one. Perhaps he'll be able to make it dance again.
You know, Ollie, it still seems strange to think that we can talk to Raymond like this. We are so blessed.
We are.
Oliver, please don't be offended by what I say. But why do you never really talk to Raymond?
I talk all the time. We're always holding seances.
No, I talk to him. Honor talks talks to him. We tell him how much we miss him, how we love him. But you just sit there, asking questions and taking notes. What plane are you on? What are the houses made of? Can you read books?
I'm interested. And Raymond gives me answers. Answers which are evidence for the survival of memory and affection after death.
There's no evidence of affection in anything you say to Raymond. Why not, Ollie? He's your son, not a case study. He's your son.
What do you want me to say?
Well, I don't know. That you're proud of him. That
he knows that I loved him. I love him.
Does he?
Of course. I'm his father.
Well, tonight, you can be his father for once.
Just the one candle.
Are we ready? Mama? Papa?
I'm ready.
Then let us begin.
We always say a little prayer first.
Amen. Is anyone here tonight to speak to us?
Do come if you can. Raymond, dear? Do you think you could come to us? Raymond, are you there?
I don't think it's any good tonight, Mama.
But Raymond always comes.
Raymond?
Did you feel the table move?
No.
Raymond, I felt it move, I'm sure.
No.
Is anyone coming? Is anyone there? Raymond!
I'm getting that drawing feeling through my hands and arms. I'm certain of it.
I don't think Raymond is coming anymore. I think he's said all he needs to say.
No, he must come. Raymond, old man. Please, we have so much to say to you. I have so much to say to you.
He's gone. Papa.
I'm sorry, Raymond. I'm sorry.
Second Lieutenant Lodge. R. South Lancashire Regiment. Killed in action. 26 years.
Too many crosses. I'm glad we came. Thank you, Ollie.
Pity. I wanted to come here. To be where he was when he died. No amount of talking through mediums can give one this sense of closeness.
Are you happy, Ollie?
Of course.
Everyone says there's jolly old Ollie. But deep down, I don't think you are. I don't think you've ever been.
Maybe all right. Maybe I've wasted my life. Flitting from idea to idea like a gadfly. Moving from one unfinished project to the next simply because it excites my imagination. When you married me, you thought I was going to achieve great things.
And you have, haven't you? Inventing wireless.
Mary.
I know what you're going to say. But as far as I'm concerned, if it hadn't been for you, I mean, Marconi was only ever interested in making money and the power his patents gave him. Without your discovery, he would have had nothing of value. He would have been nowhere.
Well, if you put it like that.
There aren't many men who can say they've met Einstein, that Einstein sought them out.
There was much excitement in the canteen that day. But I'm afraid I was something of a curiosity for him.
No.
Sometimes the future likes to drop in on the past, purely out of good manners, to shake hands with an ancestor before it's too late. I'd have given everything. Everything to have the real Raymond back.
But you did, Ollie.
Did I? You know, I'm not so sure. Raymond doesn't come anymore. I haven't spoken to him for years. The mediums have been losing interest in the war. I know they're as busy as ever, fighting science now, I suppose, or some battle with the bishops, or touting their healing powers. But I don't hear them talking about boys like our Raymond. Perhaps it doesn't pay to keep all that sadness alive after all these years. Perhaps it was never Raymond speaking at all.
You don't believe that. Do you, Ollie? Do you?
Is there anyone?
I've been experimenting throughout the week.
Is there anybody there?
Broadcasting from the air.
Is there anybody there? Is there anybody there?
So, to the final stage of the experiment. Mrs. Lawrence, are you ready?
I am.
A bit of hyperventilation usually gets things going. Thrashing and moaning usually goes down well too.
The table, mind she doesn't hurt herself.
No, she won't. I've seen this before. Her control will be along any minute. Thank heavens. Thought that was going on a bit. Can get very tedious. Spoke too soon. I wonder who she's brought along this time.
Why? You call me when I'm sleeping.
Red Feather. Now, I like this one. Not exactly original, but bags of style.
Is Professor Lodge with you, Red Feather?
Yes, I'm here.
No answer.
I said I'm here.
We must make contact with the professor.
I'm here. I think it must be a dodgy connection at your end.
Yes. The professor is here. He's standing right next to Redfeather.
Tuned in.
Is the professor well?
Tell them I feel awful.
The professor say he never felt better. Very happy to see all.
Ah.
Can the professor tell us what is in the envelope?
Well, that's the funny thing, you see.
Pa, what's happening?
Raymond, old man. We're at the Society for Psychic Research, London, 1954. My experiment? They want me to tell them what's in the third envelope.
They're making an awful din.
Don't joke. This is serious. I'm afraid I've quite forgotten what I put in that envelope.
Pa.
Professor Lodge is fading, going away.
Please, Professor, please don't go.
I'm here.
He gone. I go now.
I don't think we're going to get a coherent answer out of her. The final envelope, please. It's a drawing of a seashell.
Of course, the seashell. How did I ever forget that?
A seashell? What does that mean, Pa?
Well, you know how when you hold a shell to your ear, you can hear the sea, no matter where you are?
Of course, every boy knows that. But it's not really the sea.
Is there anybody there?
Drama on Three, Between Two Worlds, was written by Adrian Bean and David Hendy, who was also the historical consultant. Oliver Lodge was played by Owen Teal and Mary Lodge by Amanda Root. Raymond was Sandy Grierson. Honor, Madeline Worrell. Alec, Jim Webster Stewart. Mrs. Kennedy, Mrs. Lawrence and Mrs. Piper, Caroline Strong. Mrs. Leonard and Fedder, Madeline Brolly. Myers, Padre and other parts, Crawford Logan. Waitress, Catherine Fitzgerald. And the boy, Sebastian Cook. The sound design was by Joe Atchison. It was directed and produced by Matt Thompson and was a Rocket House production for BBC Radio 3.
Vigour and adventure course through the Royal Albert Hall in Thursday's BBC Prom. Lewis joins the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra performing Beethoven's Second Piano Concerto. Katie Durham is your host for the BBC Proms this Thursday at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, at 11:30 tonight, we'll be joining Andrew McGregor for another of our live broadcasts from the 2010 WOMAD Festival. Now, though, it's 10:15 and time for Words and Music. Tonight's theme is A Beat in Time, a programme first broadcast in 2007. The poems and prose are read by the actors Greta Scacchi and Greg Wise, along with archive of the poet R.S. Thomas.
To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under the sun.
A time to be born, and a time to die.
A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted.
A time to kill, and a time to heal.
A time to weep, and a time to laugh.
A time to mourn, and a time to dance.
A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing.
A time to lose, and a time to seek.
A time to rend, and a time to sow.
A time to keep silent, and a time to speak.
A time to love, and a time to hate.
A time for war, and a time for peace.
Love set you going like a fat gold watch. The midwife slapped your footsoles and your bald cry took its place among the elements. Our voices echo, magnifying your arrival. New statue. In a drafty museum, your nakedness shadows our safety. We stand round blankly as walls. I'm no more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand. All night, your moth breath flickers among the flat pink roses. I wake to listen. A far sea moves in my ear. One cry, and I stumble from bed, cow-heavy and floral in my Victorian nightgown. Your mouth opens, clean as a cat's. The window square whitens and swallows its dull stars, and now you try your handful of notes. The clear vowels rise like balloons.
When I am old, and a bushfire of booze veins crackles across a face with a nose like a squeezed tea bag, I shall consort with similarly time-mugged parties, and we shall play Elizabeth Schumann singing Schubert's Litany for the Feast of the Dead, because it is beautiful, and there's nothing to say. And because it is beautiful, and there's nothing to say, we shall lean towards each other and murmur an antique catchphrase in a knowing way. Elizabeth Schumann singing Schubert's Litany for the Feast of the Dead rules, okay? Okay. Okay.